ISIS Audiobooks presents an unabridged recording of 3001, A Final Odyssey, written by Arthur C. Clarke, read by Garrick Hagen. Prologue, The Firstborn. Call them the Firstborn. Though they were not remotely human, they were flesh and blood. And when they looked out across the deeps of space, they felt awe and wonder and loneliness. As soon as they possessed the power, they began to seek for fellowship among the stars. In their explorations, they encountered life in many forms, and watched the workings of evolution on a thousand worlds. They saw how often the first faint sparks of intelligence flickered and died in the cosmic night. And because, in all the galaxy, they had found nothing more precious than mind, they encouraged its dawning everywhere. They became farmers in the fields of stars. They sowed, and sometimes they reaped. And sometimes, dispassionately, they had to weed. The great dinosaurs had long since passed away, their morning promise annihilated by a random hammer blow from space, when the survey ship entered the solar system after a voyage that had already lasted 1,000 years. It swept past the frozen outer planets, paused briefly above the deserts of dying Mars, and presently looked down on Earth. Spread out beneath them, the explorers saw a world swarming with life. For years they studied, collected, catalogued. When they had learned all that they could, they began to modify. They tinkered with the destiny of many species, on land and in the seas. But which of their experiments would bear fruit, they could not know for at least 1,000,000 years. They were patient, but they were not yet immortal. There was so much to do in this universe of 100 billion suns, and other worlds were calling. So they set out once more into the abyss, knowing that they would never come this way again. Nor was there any need. The servants they had left behind would do the rest. On Earth, the glaciers came and went, while above them the changeless moon still carried its secret from the stars. With a yet slower rhythm than the polar ice, the tides of civilization ebbed and flowed across the galaxy. Strange and beautiful and terrible empires rose and fell and passed on their knowledge to their successors. And now, out among the stars, evolution was driving towards new goals. The first explorers of Earth had long since come to the limits of flesh and blood. As soon as their machines were better than their bodies, it was time to move. First their brains and then their thoughts alone they transferred into shining new homes of metal and gemstone. In these they roamed the galaxy. They no longer built spaceships. They were spaceships. But the age of the machine entities swiftly passed. In their ceaseless experimenting, they had learned to store knowledge in the structure of space itself, and to preserve their thoughts for eternity in frozen lattices of light. Into pure energy, therefore, they presently transformed themselves. And on 1,000 worlds, the empty shells they had discarded twitched for a while in a mindless dance of death, then crumbled into dust. Now they were lords of the galaxy, and could rove at will among the stars, or sink like a subtle mist through the very interstices of space. Though they were freed at last from the tyranny of matter, they had not wholly forgotten their origin in the warm slime of a vanished sea. And their marvelous instruments still continued to function, watching over the experiment started so many ages ago. But no longer were they always obedient to the mandates of their creators. Like all material things, they were not immune to the corruption of time and its patient, unsleeping servant, entropy. And sometimes, they discovered and sought goals of their own. Part 1. Star City. Chapter 1. Comet Cowboy. Captain Dimitri Chandler, M2973.04.21/93.106, / Mars, / Space Acad, 3005. Or Dim, to his very best friends, was understandably annoyed. The message from Earth had taken 6 hours to reach the space tug Goliath, here beyond the orbit of Neptune. If it had arrived 10 minutes later, he could have answered, "Sorry, can't leave now. We've just started to deploy the sunscreen." The excuse would have been perfectly valid. Wrapping a comet's core in a sheet of reflective film only a few molecules thick, but kilometers on a side, was not the sort of job you could abandon while it was half completed. Still, it would be a good idea to obey this ridiculous request. He was already in disfavor sunwards, through no fault of his own. Collecting ice from the rings of Saturn and nudging it towards Venus and Mercury, where it was really needed, had started back in the 2700s, 3 centuries ago. Captain Chandler had never been able to see any real difference in the before and after images the solar conservers were always producing to support their accusations of celestial vandalism, but the general public, still sensitive to the ecological disasters of previous centuries, had thought otherwise. And the hands-off Saturn vote had passed by a substantial majority. As a result, Chandler was no longer a ring rustler, but a comet cowboy. So here he was, at an appreciable fraction of the distance to Alpha Centauri, rounding up stragglers from the Kuiper Belt. There was certainly enough ice out here to cover Mercury and Venus with oceans kilometers deep, but it might take centuries to extinguish their hell fires and make them suitable for life. The solar conservers, of course, were still protesting against this, though no longer with so much enthusiasm. The millions dead from the tsunami caused by the Pacific asteroid in 2304. How ironic that a land impact would have done much less damage, had reminded all future generations that the human race had too many eggs in one fragile basket. Well, Chandler told himself, it would be 50 years before this particular package reached its destination, so a delay of a week would hardly make much difference. But all the calculations about rotation, center of mass, and thrust vectors would have to be redone and radioed back to Mars for checking. It was a good idea to do your sums carefully before nudging billions of tons of ice along an orbit that might take it within hailing distance of Earth. As they had done so many times before, Captain Chandler's eyes strayed towards the ancient photograph above his desk. It showed a 3-masted steamship, dwarfed by the iceberg that was looming above it, as indeed Goliath was dwarfed at this very moment. How incredible, he had often thought, that only one long lifetime spanned the gulf between this primitive discovery and the ship that had carried the same name to Jupiter. And what would those Antarctic explorers of 1,000 years ago have made of the view from his bridge? They would certainly have been disoriented, for the wall of ice beside which Goliath was floating stretched both upwards and downwards as far as the eye could see. And it was strange-looking ice, wholly lacking the immaculate whites and blues of the frozen polar seas. In fact, it looked dirty, as indeed it was. For only some 90% was water ice. The rest was a witch's brew of carbon and sulfur compounds, most of them stable only at temperatures not far above absolute zero. Thawing them out could produce unpleasant surprises, as one astrochemist had famously remarked, "Comets have bad breath." "Skipper to all personnel," Chandler announced. "There's been a slight change of program. We've been asked to delay operations to investigate a target that Space Guard radar has picked up." "Any details?" somebody asked when the chorus of groans over the ship's intercom had died away. "Not many, but I gather it's another Millennium Committee project they've forgotten to cancel." More groans. Everyone had become heartily sick of all the events planned to celebrate the end of the 2000s. There had been a general sigh of relief when the 1st of January 3001 had passed uneventfully and the human race could resume its normal activities. Anyway, it will probably be another false alarm, like the last one. We'll get back to work just as quickly as we can. Skipper out. This was the third wild goose chase, Chandler thought morosely, he'd been involved with during his career. Despite centuries of exploration, the solar system could still produce surprises, and presumably Space Guard had a good reason for its request. He only hoped that some imaginative idiot hadn't once again sighted the fabled golden asteroid. If it did exist, which Chandler did not for a moment believe, it would be no more than a mineralogical curiosity. It would be of far less real value than the ice he was nudging sunwards to bring life to barren worlds. There was one possibility, however, which he did take quite seriously. Already the human race had scattered its robot probes through a volume of space 100 light-years across, and the Tycho monolith was sufficient reminder that much older civilizations had engaged in similar activities. There might well be other alien artifacts in the solar system or in transit through it. Captain Chandler suspected that Space Guard had something like this in mind. Otherwise, it would hardly have diverted a Class 1 space tug to go chasing after an unidentified radar blip. 5 hours later, the questing Goliath detected the echo at extreme range. Even allowing for the distance, it seemed disappointingly small. However, as it grew clearer and stronger, it began to give the signature of a metallic object, perhaps a couple of meters long. It was traveling on an orbit heading out of the solar system, so was almost certainly, Chandler decided, one of the myriad pieces of space junk that mankind had tossed towards the stars during the last millennium, and which might one day provide the only evidence that the human race had ever existed. Then it came close enough for visual inspection, and Captain Chandler realized, with awed astonishment, that some patient historian was still checking the earliest records of the space age. What a pity that the computers had given him the answer, just a few years too late for the millennium celebrations. Goliath here, Chandler radioed earthwards, his voice tinged with pride as well as solemnity. We're bringing aboard a 1,000-year-old astronaut. And I can guess who it is. Chapter 2. Awakening. Frank Poole awoke, but he did not remember. He was not even sure of his name. Obviously, he was in a hospital room, even though his eyes were still closed, the most primitive and evocative of his senses told him that. Each breath brought the faint and not unpleasant tang of antiseptics in the air, and it triggered a memory of the time when, of course, as a reckless teenager, he had broken a rib in the Arizona Hang Gliding Championship. Now it was all beginning to come back. I'm Deputy Commander Frank Poole, Executive Officer, USSS Discovery, on a top-secret mission to Jupiter. It seemed as if an icy hand had gripped his heart. He remembered in slow-motion playback that runaway space pod jetting towards him, metal claws outstretched. Then the silent impact and the not-so-silent hiss of air rushing out of his suit. After that, one last memory of spinning helplessly in space, trying in vain to reconnect his broken air hose. Well, whatever mysterious accident had happened to the space pod controls, he was safe now. Presumably Dave had made a quick EVA and rescued him before lack of oxygen could do permanent brain damage. Good old Dave, he told himself. I must thank... Just a moment. I'm obviously not aboard Discovery now. Surely I haven't been unconscious long enough to be taken back to Earth. His confused train of thought was abruptly broken by the arrival of a matron and two nurses, wearing the immemorial uniform of their profession. They seemed a little surprised. Poole wondered if he had awakened ahead of schedule, and the idea gave him a childish feeling of satisfaction. "Hello," he said, after several attempts. His vocal cords appeared to be very rusty. "How am I doing?" Matron smiled back at him and gave an obvious, "Don't try to talk," command by putting a finger to her lips. Then the two nurses fussed swiftly over him with practiced skill, checking pulse, temperature, reflexes. When one of them lifted his right arm and let it drop again, Poole noticed something peculiar. It fell slowly, and did not seem to weigh as much as normal. Nor, for that matter, did his body when he attempted to move. "So I must be on a planet," he thought. "Or a space station with artificial gravity, certainly not Earth. I don't weigh enough." He was about to ask the obvious question when Matron pressed something against the side of his neck. He felt a slight tingling sensation and sank back into a dreamless sleep. Just before he became unconscious, he had time for one more puzzled thought. How odd. They never spoke a single word. All the time they were with me. Chapter 3. Rehabilitation. When he woke again and found Matron and nurses standing round his bed, Poole felt strong enough to assert himself. "Where am I? Surely you can tell me that." The three women exchanged glances, obviously uncertain what to do next. Then Matron answered, enunciating her words very slowly and carefully. "Everything is fine, Mr. Poole. Professor Anderson will be here in a minute. He will explain." "Explain what?" thought Poole with some exasperation. "But at least she speaks English, even though I can't place her accent." Anderson must have been already on his way, for the door opened moments later, to give Poole a brief glimpse of a small crowd of inquisitive onlookers peering in at him. He began to feel like a new exhibit at a zoo. Professor Anderson was a small, dapper man, whose features seemed to have combined key aspects of several races, Chinese, Polynesian, Nordic, in a thoroughly confusing fashion. He greeted Poole by holding up his right palm, then did an obvious double take and shook hands, with such a curious hesitation that he might have been rehearsing some quite unfamiliar gesture. "Glad to see you're looking so well, Mr. Poole. We'll have you up in no time." Again that odd accent and slow delivery, but the confident bedside manner was that of all doctors, in all places and all ages. "I'm glad to hear it. Now perhaps you can answer a few questions." "Of course, of course. But just a minute." Anderson spoke so rapidly and quietly to the matron that Poole could catch only a few words, several of which were wholly unfamiliar to him. Then the matron nodded at one of the nurses, who opened a wall cupboard and produced a slim metal band, which she proceeded to wrap around Poole's head. "What's that for?" he asked, being one of those difficult patients, so annoying to doctors, who always want to know just what's happening to them. "EEG readout?" Professor, matron, and nurses looked equally baffled. Then a slow smile spread across Anderson's face. "Oh, electroencephalogram," he said slowly, as if dredging the word up from the depth of memory. "You're quite right. We just want to monitor your brain functions." "My brain would function perfectly well if you'd let me use it," Poole grumbled silently, "but at least we seem to be getting somewhere." Finally, "Mr. Poole," said Anderson, still speaking in that curious, stilted voice, as if venturing in a foreign language, "you know, of course, that you were disabled in a serious accident while you were working outside Discovery." Poole nodded agreement. "I'm beginning to suspect," he said dryly, "that disabled is a slight understatement." Anderson relaxed visibly, and a slow smile spread across his face. You're quite correct. Tell me what you think happened.
Well, the best case scenario is that after I became unconscious, Dave Bowman rescued me and brought me back to the ship. How is Dave? No one will tell me anything.
All in due course.
And the worst case?
It seemed to Frank Poole that a chill wind was blowing gently on the back of his neck. The suspicion that had been slowly forming in his mind began to solidify.
That I died, but was brought back here, wherever here is, and you've been able to revive me.
Thank you.
Quite correct.
And you're back on Earth.
Well, very near it.
What did he mean by very near it?
There was certainly a gravity field here, so he was probably inside the slowly turning wheel of an orbiting space station. No matter. There was something much more important to think about.
Poole did some quick mental calculations. If Dave had put him in the hibernaculum, revived the rest of the crew, and completed the mission to Jupiter, why, he could have been dead for as much as 5 years.
Just what date is it? He asked as calmly as possible.
Professor and matron exchanged glances. Again, Poole felt that cold wind on his neck.
I must tell you, Mr. Poole, that Bowman did not rescue you. He believed, and we cannot blame him, that you were irrevocably dead. Also, he was facing a desperately serious crisis that threatened his own survival. So, you drifted on into space, passed through the Jupiter system, and headed out towards the stars. Fortunately, you were so far below freezing point that there was no metabolism. But it's a near miracle that you were ever found at all. You are one of the luckiest men alive. No, ever to have lived.
Am I? Poole asked himself bleakly. 5 years, indeed. It could be a century. Or even more.
Let me have it, he demanded.
Professor and matron seemed to be consulting an invisible monitor. When they looked at each other and nodded agreement, Poole guessed that they were all plugged into the hospital information circuit linked to the headband he was wearing.
Frank, said Professor Anderson, making a smooth switch to the role of long-time family physician, this will be a great shock to you. But you're capable of accepting it. And the sooner you know, the better. We're near the beginning of the fourth millennium. Believe me, you left Earth almost 1,000 years ago.
I believe you, Poole answered calmly.
Then, to his great annoyance, the room started to spin around him, and he knew nothing more.
When he regained consciousness, he found that he was no longer in a bleak hospital room, but in a luxurious suite with attractive and steadily changing images on the walls. Some of these were famous and familiar paintings, others showed land and seascapes that might have been from his own time. There was nothing alien or upsetting. That, he guessed, would come later. His present surroundings had obviously been very carefully programmed. He wondered if there was the equivalent of a television screen somewhere. How many channels would the fourth millennium have? But could see no sign of any controls near his bed. There was so much he would have to learn in this new world. He was a savage who had suddenly encountered civilization. But first, he must regain his strength. And learn the language. Not even the advent of sound recording, already more than a century old when Poole was born, had prevented major changes in grammar and pronunciation. And there were thousands of new words, mostly from science and technology, though often he was able to make a shrewd guess at their meaning.
More frustrating, however, were the myriad of famous and infamous personal names that had accumulated over the millennium and which meant nothing to him. For weeks, until he had built up a data bank, most of his conversations had to be interrupted with potted biographies. As Poole's strength increased, so did the number of his visitors, though always under Professor Anderson's watchful eye. They included medical specialists, scholars of several disciplines, and, of the greatest interest to him, spacecraft commanders. There was little that he could tell the doctors and historians that was not recorded somewhere in mankind's gigantic data banks, but he was often able to give them research shortcuts and new insights about the events of his own time. Though they all treated him with the utmost respect and listened patiently as he tried to answer their questions, they seemed reluctant to answer his. Poole began to feel that he was being overprotected from culture shock, and half seriously wondered how he could escape from his suite. On the few occasions he was alone, he was not surprised to discover that the door was locked. Then, the arrival of Dr. Indra Wallace changed everything. Despite her name, her chief racial component appeared to be Japanese, and there were times when, with just a little imagination, Poole could picture her as a rather mature geisha girl. It was hardly an appropriate image for a distinguished historian, holding a virtual chair at a university still boasting real ivy. She was the first visitor with a fluent command of Poole's own English, so he was delighted to meet her.
"Mr. Poole," she began in a very businesslike voice, "I've been appointed your official guide and, let's say, mentor. My qualifications... I've specialized in your period. My thesis was The Collapse of the Nation-State, 2000 to 2050. I believe we can help each other in many ways."
"I'm sure we can. First, I'd like you to get me out of here so I can see a little of your world."
"Exactly what we intend to do. But first, we must give you an ident. Until then, you'll be... what was the term? Non-person. It would be almost impossible for you to go anywhere or get anything done. No input device would recognize your existence."
"Just what I expected," Poole answered with a wry smile. "It was starting to get that way in my own time, and many people hated the idea."
"Some still do. They go off and live in the wilderness. There's a lot more on Earth than there was in your century. But they always take their compacts with them, so they can call for help as soon as they get into trouble. The median time is about 5 days.
"Sorry to hear that. The human race has obviously deteriorated."
He was cautiously testing her, trying to find the limits of her tolerance and to map out her personality. It was obvious that they were going to spend much time together, and that he would have to depend upon her in hundreds of ways. Yet he was still not sure if he would even like her. Perhaps she regarded him merely as a fascinating museum exhibit. Rather to Poole's surprise, she agreed with his criticism.
"That may be true, in some respects. Perhaps we're physically weaker, but we're healthier and better adjusted than most humans who have ever lived. The noble savage was always a myth."
She walked over to a small rectangular plate, set at eye level in the door. It was about the size of one of the countless magazines that had proliferated in the far-off age of print, and Poole had noticed that every room seemed to have at least one. Usually they were blank, but sometimes they contained lines of slowly scrolling text, completely meaningless to Poole, even when most of the words were familiar. Once a plate in his suite had emitted urgent beepings, which he had ignored on the assumption that someone else would deal with the problem, whatever it was. Fortunately, the noise stopped as abruptly as it had started. Dr. Wallace laid the palm of her hand upon the plate, then removed it after a few seconds. She glanced at Poole and said smilingly,
"Come and look at this."
The inscription that had suddenly appeared made a good deal of sense when he read it slowly. Wallace. Indra. F2970.03.11:31.885/hist, Oxford.
I suppose it means female, date of birth 11th of March 2970, and that you're associated with the Department of History at Oxford. And I guess that 31.885 is a personal identification number. Correct? Excellent, Mr. Poole. I've seen some of your email addresses and credit card numbers, hideous strings of alphanumeric gibberish that no one could possibly remember. But we all know our date of birth, and not more than 99,999 other people will share it. So a five-figure number is all you'll ever need. And even if you forget that, it doesn't really matter. As you see, it's a part of you. Implant? Yes. Nanochip at birth. One in each palm for redundancy. You won't even feel yours when it goes in. But you've given us a small problem. What's that? The readers you'll meet most of the time are too simple-minded to believe your date of birth. So, with your permission, we've moved it up 1,000 years. Permission granted. And the rest of the ident? Optional. You can leave it empty, give your current interests and location, or use it for personal messages, global or targeted. Some things, Poole was quite sure, would not have changed over the centuries. A high proportion of those targeted messages would be very personal indeed. He wondered if there were still self- or state-appointed censors in this day and age, and if their efforts at improving other people's morals had been more successful than in his own time. He would have to ask Dr. Wallace about that, when he got to know her better. Chapter 4. A Room with a View. Frank, Professor Anderson thinks you're strong enough to go for a little walk.
I'm very pleased to hear it. Do you know the expression, stir crazy?
No, but I can guess what it means.
Poole had so adapted to the low gravity that the long strides he was taking seemed perfectly normal. Half a G, he had estimated, just right to give a sense of well-being. They met only a few people on their walk, all of them strangers, but every one gave a smile of recognition. By now, Poole told himself with a trace of smugness, I must be one of the best-known celebrities in this world. That should be a great help when I decide what to do with the rest of my life. At least another century, if I can believe Anderson. The corridor along which they were walking was completely featureless, apart from occasional numbered doors, each bearing one of the universal recog panels. Poole had followed Indra for perhaps 200 meters when he came to a sudden halt, shocked because he had not realized something so blindingly obvious.
"This space station must be enormous," he exclaimed.
Indra smiled back at him.
"Didn't you have a saying, you ain't seen anything yet?"
"Nothing," he corrected absent-mindedly. He was still trying to estimate the scale of this structure when he had another surprise. Who would have imagined a space station large enough to boast a subway? Admittedly a miniature one, with a single small coach capable of seating only 12 passengers.
"Observation Lounge 3, ordered Indra, and they drew silently and swiftly away from the terminal.
Poole checked the time on the elaborate wristband whose functions he was still exploring. One minor surprise had been that the whole world was now on universal time. The confusing patchwork of time zones had been swept away by the advent of global communications. There had been much talk of this back in the 21st century, and it had even been suggested that solar should be replaced by sidereal time. Then, during the course of the year, the sun would move right round the clock, setting at the time it had risen 6 months earlier. However, nothing had come of this equal time in the sun proposal, or of even more vociferous attempts to reform the calendar.
That particular job, it had been cynically suggested, would have to wait for somewhat major advances in technology. Someday, surely, one of God's minor mistakes would be corrected and the Earth's orbit would be adjusted to give every year 12 months of 30 exactly equal days. As far as Poole could judge by speed and elapsed time, they must have traveled at least 3 kilometers before the vehicle came to a silent stop. The doors opened, and a bland auto voice intoned, "Have a good view. 35% cloud cover today." At last, thought Poole, we're getting near the outer wall. But here was another mystery. Despite the distance he had gone, neither the strength nor the direction of gravity had altered. He cannot imagine a spinning space station so huge that the G-vector would not be changed by such a displacement. Could he really be on some planet after all? But he would feel lighter, usually much lighter, on any other habitable world in the solar system. When the outer door of the terminal opened and Poole found himself entering a small airlock, he realized that he must indeed be in space. But where were the space suits? He looked around anxiously. It was against all his instincts to be so close to vacuum, naked and unprotected. One experience of that was enough. "We are nearly there," said Indra reassuringly. The last door opened, and he was looking out into the utter blackness of space through a huge window that was curved both vertically and horizontally. He felt like a goldfish in its bowl, and hoped that the designers of this audacious piece of engineering knew exactly what they were doing. They certainly possessed better structural materials than had existed in his time. Though the stars must be shining out there, his light-adapted eyes could see nothing but black emptiness beyond the curve of the great window. As he started to walk towards it to get a wider view, Indra restrained him and pointed straight ahead. "Look carefully," she said. "Don't you see it?" Poole blinked and stared into the night. Surely it must be an illusion. Even, heaven forbid, a crack in the window. He moved his head from side to side. No. It was real. But what could it be? He remembered Euclid's definition. A line has length, but no thickness. For spanning the whole height of the window, and obviously continuing out of sight above and below, was a thread of light quite easy to see when he looked for it, yet so one-dimensional that the word thin could not even be applied. However, it was not completely featureless. There were barely visible spots of greater brilliance at irregular intervals along its length, like drops of water on a spider's web. Poole continued walking towards the window, and the view expanded until at last he could see what lay below him. It was familiar enough. The whole continent of Europe and much of northern Africa, just as he had seen them many times from space. So he was in orbit, after all, probably an equatorial one, at a height of at least 1,000 kilometers. Indra was looking at him with a quizzical smile. "Go closer to the window," she said very softly, "so that you can look straight down. I hope you have a good head for height." What a silly thing to say to an astronaut, Poole told himself as he moved forward. If I ever suffered from vertigo, I wouldn't be in this business. The thought had barely passed through his mind when he cried, "My God!" and involuntarily stepped back from the window. Then, bracing himself, he dared to look again. He was looking down on the distant Mediterranean from the face of a cylindrical tower, whose gently curving wall indicated a diameter of several kilometers. But that was nothing compared with its length, for it tapered away down, 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 until it disappeared into the mist somewhere over Africa. He assumed that it continued all the way to the surface. "How high are we?" he whispered. 2,000 K. But now look upwards." This time, it was not such a shock. He had expected what he would see. The tower dwindled away until it became a glittering thread against the blackness of space, and he did not doubt that it continued all the way to the geostationary orbit, 36,000 kilometers above the equator. Such fantasies had been well known in Poole's day. He had never dreamed he would see the reality and be living in it. He pointed towards the distant thread reaching up from the eastern horizon.
That must be another one.
Yes, the Asian Tower. We must look exactly the same to them.
How many are there?
Just four, equally spaced around the equator. Africa, Asia, America, Pacifica. The last one's almost empty, only a few hundred levels completed. Nothing to see except water.
Poole was still absorbing this stupendous concept when a disturbing thought occurred to him. There were already thousands of satellites at all sorts of altitudes in my time. How do you avoid collisions?
Indra looked slightly embarrassed.
You know, I never thought about that. It's not my field.
She paused for a moment, clearly searching her memory. Then her face brightened.
I believe there was a big cleanup operation centuries ago. There just aren't any satellites below the stationary orbit.
That made sense, Poole told himself. They wouldn't be needed. The four gigantic towers could provide all the facilities once provided by thousands of satellites and space stations.
And there have never been any accidents? Any collisions with spaceships leaving Earth or re-entering the atmosphere?
Indra looked at him with surprise.
But they don't anymore, she pointed to the ceiling. All the spaceports are where they should be, up there on the outer ring. I believe it's 400 years since the last rocket lifted off from the surface of the Earth.
Poole was still digesting this when a trivial anomaly caught his attention. His training as an astronaut had made him alert to anything out of the ordinary. In space, that might be a matter of life or death. The sun was out of view, high overhead. But its rays streaming down through the great window painted a brilliant band of light on the floor underfoot. Cutting across that band, at an angle, was another, much fainter one, so that the frame of the window threw a double shadow. Poole had to go almost down on his knees so that he could peer up at the sky. He had thought himself beyond surprise, but the spectacle of two suns left him momentarily speechless.
"What's that?"
he gasped when he had recovered his breath.
"Oh, haven't you been told? That's Lucifer."
"Earth has another sun?"
"Well, it doesn't give us much heat, but it's put the moon out of business. Before the second mission went there to look for you, that was the planet Jupiter."
"I knew I would have much to learn in this new world," Poole told himself. "But just how much? I never dreamed."
Chapter 5. Education. Poole was both astonished and delighted when the television set was wheeled into the room and positioned at the end of his bed. Delighted because he was suffering from mild information starvation, and astonished because it was a model which had been obsolete even in his own time.
"We've had to promise the museum we'll give it back," Matron informed him,
"and I expect you know how to use this."
As he fondled the remote control, Poole felt a wave of acute nostalgia sweep over him. As few other artifacts could, it brought back memories of his childhood and the days when most television sets were too stupid to understand spoken commands.
"Thank you, Matron. What's the best news channel?"
She seemed puzzled by his question, then brightened.
"Oh, I see what you mean. But Professor Anderson thinks you're not quite ready yet. So Archives has put together a collection that will make you feel at home."
Poole wondered briefly what the storage medium was in this day and age. He could still remember compact discs, and his eccentric old Uncle George had been the proud possessor of a collection of vintage videotapes. But surely that technological contest must have finished centuries ago. in the usual Darwinian way with the survival of the fittest. He had to admit that the selection was well done by someone, Indra, familiar with the early 21st century. There was nothing disturbing, no wars or violence, and very little contemporary business or politics, all of which would now be utterly irrelevant. There were some light comedies, sporting events. How did they know that he had been a keen tennis fan? Classical and pop music, and wildlife documentaries. And whoever had put this collection together had a sense of humor, or they would not have included episodes from each Star Trek series. As a very small boy, Poole had met both Patrick Stewart and Leonard Nimoy, and he wondered what they would have thought if they could have known the destiny of the child who had shyly asked for their autographs. A depressing thought occurred to him soon after he had started exploring, much of the time in Fast Forward, these relics of the past. He had read somewhere that by the turn of the century, his century, there were approximately 50,000 television stations broadcasting simultaneously. If that figure had been maintained, and it might well have increased, by now millions of hours of TV programming